Now to the case of Andy Warhol in the US Supreme Court. America's top court recently found that the Warhol Foundation breached the copyright of photographer Lynn Goldsmith when it licensed Andy Warhol's portrait of Prince to Vanity Fair for the cover of a commemorative edition after Prince died in 2016. Warhol's portrait was made in 1984, and it was based on a Lynn Goldsmith photo of Prince from 1981. A majority of the Supreme Court found in favour of Lynn Goldsmith, the photographer. Her original work, they said, is entitled to copyright protection even against famous artists. Dr. Richard Meyer is a professor of art history at Stanford University who's published and taught courses on Andy Warhol for over 25 years. He also wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court, and this week he wrote in the New York Times, "The Supreme Court got it wrong." Dr. Richard Meyer, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Why did the Supreme Court get it wrong, Richard?
Well, one of the major tests of fair, what is called fair use, which means that you can use copyrighted material without payment or permission because you're so much transforming it, it's become so transformed that it's no longer the same work. It's an independent, it's a freestanding work. And the reason the government did this, it was part of the 1976 Copyright Act, was to foster freedom of expression so that artists and scholars, like, for example, teachers under this Fair Use Act, they can make Xeroxes of texts and images and hand them out in class without permission. So that there was this idea, which I think is very important as a scholar or myself and a teacher, that there should be, to some extent, a free circulation of information and imagery. Now, that doesn't mean that it's an open field of play where you could just rip anything off that you want to, but it does mean that there are limits to what copyright protection allows, and there is, again, within very specified areas of this what is called fair use, which means it's fair to use it. Now, of course, as in anything, when I say specified areas, there's all kinds of contestation and, you know, interpretive disputes over, well, what are those areas? Mm. So one of them, the one that I focused on in my brief, has to do with transformation. I think I mentioned that. And so I argued, look, the way that Warhol takes a photograph, crops it, makes it into a silkscreen, passes ink or paint through the many different silkscreen for each color. And as you know, Warhol's, there's multiple colors, often these day glow brilliant colors. The way he flattens the image so that it becomes iconic, often part of the image is actually not even fully visible because the paint has overlaid the underlying photographic image and overwhelmed it. So I argued, oh, well, this is not the same image. If you just look at it for a moment, it's been transformed.
So, Richard, what did the Supreme Court majority say about this idea of transformation? Because the two images, even though one's based on the photograph, they do look very different, and I think Warhol's work is generally regarded as the sort of epitome of transformative copying. Exactly. What did the Supreme Court majority say about that?
So the Supreme Court majority took a different clause from this fair use, this doctrine that was, as I said, ratified in 76, and that was purpose. So is the purpose of the two images the same? And in this case, they said that was too much the same because Lynn Goldsmith, who's a rock and roll commercial photographer, she sells her images, tries to sell her images to magazines and does. And in this one case, it's not Warhol sold this image, or rather the Andy Warhol Foundation licensed this image. Warhol was dead at the time that Prince died. So, you know, it was his foundation. And they're in control of all the licensing of every Warhol work. They did not seek, they felt that it was a Warhol work and they didn't need Lynn Goldsmith's permission, but they did place it, as you mentioned, on the cover of a magazine. So the Supreme Court, I think very surprisingly, at least to me, if I had known when I was writing the amicus brief, that they would focus on purpose, because in earlier cases, the lower courts had all focused, and in other fair use cases, it's often, and I think almost always, although I'm not a lawyer, but from what I understand, transformation has been the key criteria. And in this case, it was very narrowly decided on purpose. Oh, okay, this one went into a magazine, that one went into a magazine, so it's not fair use. They're doing the same thing. They should pay for the license fee to the photographer.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court majority at least seems to have more focused on, the decision of the Warhol Foundation selling its image, the image that it owns, to a magazine, which is what Lynn Goldsmith had done originally. But you see some dangers in this decision, Dr. Richard Meyer, and the dissenting judgment in the case, which was written by Justice Elena Kagan, and I think Chief Justice Roberts agreed with that one, is closer to what you think the position should be. You say the dissent gets it right. Why is that?
Well, one thing I'll say right off the bat is I'm going to assign this dissenting opinion to my art history students because it's excellent. It has all these reproductions of, old master paintings as well as Warhol's. But one reason why it gets it right, she actually quotes a lyric from The Sound of Music, which is nothing comes from nothing. And so she goes back through the history of art and says, look, every work, including what have been considered some of the greatest work in art history, they're based on sources. Artists don't create from whole cloth, from a tabula rasa. And so she was, I'm saying she because Justice Kagan wrote the decision to which—
That's right.
You're right, Roberts concurred. But I thought it was brilliantly argued and written because it was so rigorously based in art history, not just Warhol in 20th century, the modern period, but going back to the old masters. And so what she was saying is a little bit what I was just trying to gesture toward, that purpose is too narrow a criteria. But what she said I hadn't even thought of. I wish I had, because I would have put it in my amicus brief. Not that that would have persuaded anyone, but, to vote differently. But in any event, what she said was, look, the problem is sometimes artists, of course, the Andy Warhol Foundation can afford the license fee, but artists who maybe are just starting out or student artists, they may not be able to afford. And I could tell you from scholarly publication, the license fees can be several thousand dollars, which for me, when I was a graduate student and a junior professor, that was a lot of money for me at the time. And I kind of felt like I'm not going to ever make any money from, an art history book. This should be in public domain. I still feel that way. I think all images for scholarly and publication use should be in public domain. But she said, sorry, to go back to the publication of art by artists or the circulation of art, Justice Kagan said that A, some artists won't be able to afford it, but B, there will be times where the artist who owns the copyright or the foundation or whatever will not allow for its reproduction because they don't like the purpose to which it is being put. And that within scholarly circles, I have no friends who have had to publish articles blank. All the images were refused copyright. So they literally, in one case, my friend published rectangle blank frames with the caption of what the images were supposed to be, and a note that they'd all been refused.
So that's interesting. So the minority says that this decision hampers creative progress and undermines creative freedom, although the majority seems to be trying to protect a different artist, the photographer in this case. It's a fascinating balancing act.
Yeah, and I will say, I'm going to confide in you and your listeners. This is something I didn't say in the op-ed, and I didn't say in the amicus brief, and you'll understand why. I would have had no problem. The Andy Warhol Foundation could have paid Lynn Goldsmith, a licensing fee to be But I will say in their defense, I don't think it would have occurred to them, because I think they saw this as a completely freestanding work. Like if it were me, for example, as a scholar, and I were publishing the Andy Warhol, I never would go back to the source image, because that's what he based his work on, but this work was his vision. However, when she asked for the fee, and I don't know what it was, but I can't imagine it was, you know, it was anything the Warhol Foundation could not afford. I
mean, yes, because they don't receive $10,000 from Condé Nast, so we're not dealing with, it certainly sounds like the amount of money spent on the court case would have far exceeded what the license fee they could have paid.
Exactly, and I don't know the whole history. Maybe they were worried about setting a precedent where then every, you know, source image maker would be coming after the founder. I just don't know. They didn't share that with me. But I will say, you know, as an art historian, as a professor, I'm always trying to see both sides and have my students, you know, be able to make a debate or, you know, interpret the issues in an even-handed way. But the law works quite differently. You're on one side or the other, you know. So they didn't tell me what to say, but I understood, look, if I'm arguing, and I do really believe in the doctrine of fair use. I mean, I believe that I made the right argument, but off the record, I would have said, just pay her the fee and avoid this whole thing.
Maybe you know, so, just, yes.
It's going to be a lot cheaper.
Dr. Richard Meyer is a professor of art history, but with some very practical advice about how to deal with some of these art disputes. Richard is an Andy Warhol scholar, and he wrote in the New York Times this week that the Supreme Court got the recent Andy Warhol versus Lynn Goldsmith decision wrong. And in your New York Times article, Richard, you write that Andy Warhol was concerned not with copyright, but with the right to copy, which he saw both as a creative method and as a design for living. Could you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. I mean, I think that to appreciate Warhol's contribution, and not only to art history, but to our culture more widely, one has to take into account that when he emerged as a, you know, an artist in the, you know, who was written about in the magazines and who was getting shows, what he was doing by copying, this is in the early 60s, copying popular magazines, copying ads, copying brand packaging like Campbell soup cans, that was largely, almost by the critics, considered vulgar, considered something that fine art should not be involved with. In fact, I remember one critic said, look, I don't like going to the supermarket when I have to go. I certainly don't want to go to the supermarket when I go to an art gallery. You know, I don't want to be confronted with all these supermarket products. And of course, the achievement was he wanted us to think about how we are confronted constantly with this endless stream of celebrity images, of consumer products. The repetitions mattered to him because that's how mass culture and commercial culture work. And in a sense, those repetitions are looking at not just the image, but the system that produces and relentlessly reproduces the image. I also mentioned when I said a design for living, you know, at one point he hired an actor friend of his to be Warhol. Warhol was asked to do a lecture tour and he didn't want to do it. He didn't like public appearances. He didn't like talking so much. So he sent this friend, the man like sort of, you know, fixed his hair, put on makeup so that he looked a little more like Warhol. And he gave these lectures, and finally the ruse was, not finally, inevitably, after I think three lectures, the ruse was revealed, and Warhol said, well, he was better at being me than I am. You know? And I think, and so in the piece, I say, we don't need to hire actors anymore. We have our Instagram and Tinder profiles that are better, that, you know, that we put out there because we think, or we enhance ourselves, you know, in the public eye. And I really do feel that this notion of the copy, not even to mention artificial intelligence and chat, what is it called?
ChatGPT. Yeah, well, I imagine that Andy Warhol would very much embrace the idea of computers being able to create Andy Warhol works of art. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, he embraced the idea of Andy Warhol being able to ask people to make his works of art for him, you know. And he didn't literally have people make the whole artwork, but he did have them do the titling or the cropping or the silk screening. And he even asked friends, what should I paint next? You know, an artist is not supposed to be asking for ideas. They're supposed to have ideas. And isn't this what ChatGPT does? It produces the ideas we wished we had, or at least the illusion of ideas, you know, in terms of the words. And that's why I say Warhol might have savored these technologies, but university professors grading student papers do not, you know, because I need to know that the student actually wrote the paper, because that's what learning is. And I do worry, I mean, in all honesty, I do worry that these technologies will dissuade students from understanding the importance of original, human, you know, unique thought, their own
yes,
thoughts.
I can appreciate, Richard, that you want original human essays about Andy Warhol's copying of mechanically
exactly.
reproduced soup cans and the like. That does make sense to me. Just out
right.
of interest, your article also, Richard, had an interesting little bit of history about what the Campbell's Soup Company did when Andy Warhol famously used their logo in his art. That one didn't end up in the Supreme Court.
No, that's one of my favorite stories. As I mentioned, I often tell my students when I teach pop art. So Random House was about to publish an Andy Warhol book, you know, like sort of a coffee table book that had several images of the soup cans, of the paintings of soup cans in it. And so they, you know, were concerned exactly about this, about copyright. So they contacted Campbell's Soup, and Campbell's Soup said, oh, don't worry, there's absolutely no conflict between our copyright and Warhol's use of it. In fact, it's been good for business. but we want to specify that he should never paint our logo on soup cans, because then he would be in competition with us. And I point out that Warhol was happy to comply, since he was making art, not soup.
Well, yes, yeah. Although I did wonder whether that might have been a red soup can rag to a bull if Andy Warhol had known about it. But he was happy not to compete with the soup makers, was he?
Well, I think, to be honest, you know, he was making a lot more money selling those paintings than he could selling soup cans. Oh, but I do mention that a few years later, people started to bring Campbell's soup cans to his public appearances. Grocery bought Campbell's soup cans for him to sign, almost as though it were a work of art by Andy Warhol. So the source material of the artwork sort of switched places.
Well, it's been fascinating discussing the Supreme Court case with you, Richard Meyer, and it certainly is a cracking read, because there's some very, very sharp differences of opinion and some catty references between the judges. So it's a cracking yarn, but thanks very much for bringing it to us on Sunday Extra.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Dr. Richard Meyer is Professor of Art History at Stanford University and an Andy Warhol expert. He also wrote an amicus brief in the case of the Warhol Foundation versus Goldsmith, recently decided by the US Supreme Court.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.